There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello. Do you like a chatter?
I do.
Do you like a natter?
I do.
Well, you'll like chatter natter with Andy Tong, our guest for today. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Andy. You all right?
Yeah.
He's very well behaved.
He is not like that Carl Oak.
Sorry?
Always well behaved.
Always, always, always. It's like a... Now, we're here to do a chat and answer with you on the subject of your Militaria collection. You have quite a reasonable sized Militaria collection compared to mine.
Say all the girls.
Hey. And firstly, Gary wants to ask you a question about something. What do you want to ask, Gary?
Well, I'd like to know, Andy, what sort of got you into the collection? You've got an interest in the Great War, and I've seen you on a number of battlefield tours, for example. But why collecting?
Oh, that's quite simple. It started when I was in my early teens and finding at home my father's cap badge from World War II. He'd been invited to join the army in 1939, the sort of invitation that one doesn't say, can we put it off for a few months? And he ended up going to India, moved overland from India to the Western Desert, arriving just about the end of May 1942. And with his battalion, he went to a little place called Bir al-Harmat, just on the edge of the Cauldron. And we all know what happened on the Cauldron, don't we, Gary?
Yes, it's in Peter's book, At Close Range.
It's as if it was scripted.
So his battalion was guarding the gap in the minefields where 15th Panzer Division came, and basically they took about 75% casualties. He ended up in an Italian hospital. And then got moved to Germany, where he spent the rest of the war digging coal for the Germans, based out of Lambsdorff in Silesia.
That's quite a war record. I wish we'd interviewed him.
No, he did one of the POW death marches and ended up at Regensburg. Or I think it was actually Moosburg in Austria. But he never talked about it much, as very few of them did.
Except to us, the War Museum. That was compulsory.
So that's what kicked me off.
And is that what kicked you off in your interest in military history or in collecting, or is it both?
Probably both. I started very much as a collector, collecting badges, saving badges.
And was it Second World War, like your dad's?
Initially, and then a friend persuaded me that I should go on the battlefield tour that he was acting as courier on. So he went to the Somme. Next year went to Ypres. Then the next year did a couple more places, including Verdun. And it sort of built from there.
And how old were you when this started? You know, when you started actually collecting properly, and when you started going to battlefield tours proper?
Started collecting properly late teens. Started getting the wider interest, the backstories for beyond the actual physical artifact when I was in my early 20s, and I just run through from there.
Most teenagers don't have a lot of disposable income, Andy. So how did you sort of afford some of these things, or were they very much cheaper in those days?
Oh, very much cheaper in those days. And what I was collecting was mainly the cap badges, which could be when I started, they were 50 pence a piece. You know, now some of those basic badges are selling £6 or £7. So there's the end of the market that's very accessible for people without going to the esoteric things that really are rocking horse shit. And there's things that give interest that are not necessarily expensive.
Did you ever move into postcards?
Military postcards, yeah. Yeah, I've got quite a lot of it because one of the interesting things that goes with owning some of the artefacts is if you can find pictures of the lads actually wearing it or using it, it actually it takes you from just being hoarding to actually collecting and understanding and starting to want to develop the history and the full picture.
So you started with badges. I mean, I remember, I think you may even have known him. You certainly know his book. Chris McCarthy said he used to collect badges and he used to go on and on about it. Then he went to work at the War Museum. They took him and showed him the War Museum's collection of badges, so he gave up. What's the bloody point? But there is there, are you one of the collectors who needs to have every badge, every variant of every badge? In other words, obsessive. Or are you just someone who wants some nice examples of most of the badges?
Right, so I've got some main themes. I've got a theme for the County of Cornwall, which is where I was brought up, and that was the regiment.
I'll be able to do the accents for you.
You certainly can, me handsome. Proper job, me handsome. Those are the key words. You master those, you're okay.
Proper job, me handsome.
That's your pirate.
No, he's pretty good. A lot of people don't speak like that. He's good.
That's also his Cockney and his Australian.
Yeah, but don't tell him that.
Oh, hang on, that was my Norwich. Sorry, carry on, Andy. We don't want to be thrown off track by an idiot.
So there's a few themes where, yes, it'd be nice to have some of to explore the corners of what was possible. Now, that goes back to really the end of the 18th century. Those are the earliest bits that are really achievable in finding.
So you broadened out from badges to Cornish militaria.
Yeah, so the uniforms, the headdress, the equipment, and then a lot of the stuff that goes within paperwork and ephemera.
So that would be more fair to say that's edging in towards obsessional with that field.
With that field. But then other interests is having some nice examples of something, rather than necessarily having everything. There are a community of collectors who look at different examples of the same cap badge. I've got 20 different variants of this. Yeah, so what? But it excites them and it obviously floats their boat, and I shouldn't really criticise someone for that, but it's not what I want to do.
Well, I collect postcards. That's why I asked about the postcards, for example. I started probably 10 years ago now. And what I actually like the ones that got something written on them, you know, rather than the blank ones, because you can get a little bit of the backstory. And one of the early ones I got was addressed to somewhere in Hendon, which was the site of where my wife worked. And I just liked the idea that I could connect to that postcard. It wasn't the best postcard, it was just interesting.
So Gary, tell you a little story. Years ago, I went to an auction in Lewes, and the auctioneer kicked everyone out at lunchtime. So we were just wandering around the town and went into the town hall where there's a little postcard fair. One, two Cornwall postcards, and bought these here because they looked interesting. Not particularly, they weren't military. Then he looked at the back of this postcard. It was addressed to a Master Jocelyn Ratcliffe. The postcard had been posted in 1906. Now, as a teenager, I used to go beating for the local pheasant shoot. That gentleman was one of the syndicate. So I picked up cards that had been sent to him, 50, 60, 70 years before?
And then you've got a personal story.
And then I had actually known this same person in later life.
Yeah, very interesting.
Now, you must have broadened your themes, because a lot of the things we're going to look at don't have a link to Cornwall. So what are you said you've got more than one theme. What are your other themes, would you reckon?
I'm interested in the First World War. I'm interested in the ground of the First World War, the people that fought, and how it panned out and how it spread its tentacles a little bit wider. So it'd be very easy to think that collecting is all about shiny things. But sometimes it's the non-shiny things that tell far, far greater stories.
Well, I know you've got a great example of that in a cookbook, which sounds ridiculous, but we'll be coming to that later. So I understand entirely that what you mean by that. Any other themes of Great War, Cornwall, anything else? Or is it just sometimes you see something that floats your boat?
Yeah, sometimes you see something that's got history. In it's something that isn't necessarily run of the mill. And if you're in a position where you do the research that goes with all of these things, it gives you the knowledge to pick up something that could actually be nondescript and something that's actually got historical importance.
Now, you mentioned research. I know you've just shown me your library. I'd count you as a book collector as well. You've got a wonderful collection of books, Great War books mainly that I saw. Is that part of your collection, do you think? Or is it also a research? Well, it's a research tool as well, fitting in with the others.
It's most definitely both, because the sort of books that you've seen are predominantly the regimental histories and divisional histories and those sort of books and official histories, which are most certainly not the sort of book. It's not a Peter Hart at close range type book where you sit down and you start at the beginning and you read the book. These are books.
Oh, I meant Blockbuster.
These are books that you dip into to get the research information.
I stayed at the Ariane Hotel about 7 or 8 years ago.
They let you in?
They did let me in. They didn't let me out again.
There was a
huge display by the stairs, I seem to recall. Might be in the lift. Of Great War uniforms, artifacts, etc. Was that something to do with you, I seem to recall?
Might be. So Natasha, who runs the Ariane, is a good friend. I was actually staying in the hotel on the battlefield the very first night she took over, about 25 years ago. A very long time. A few years ago, she said, I'm doing some extensions to the hotel. What I'd like to put into it is a little sort of mini museum. Can you help? Well, of course you help your friends out. So there was the opportunity to take some of this stuff that otherwise would be sitting in a box in an attic and get it out to where people can actually see it. Because that's one of the important things in my view in collecting.
It's not the important it's not view just, in a lot of collectors' view.
Precisely, that they hoard it and they've got to have it it's stashed away, it's my precious. And this stuff here is actually out there where, I don't know how many people a year go through the Ariane in normal times.
7.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's COVID times.
Well, exactly. But people see the stuff.
It was certainly very prominent.
And when you go there and you just stand back near reception and watch, there's always someone stopping to look at it. And that makes it worthwhile because you're sharing information, you're sharing knowledge. And you're helping, I suppose, to present a memory of the people that fought there 100 or so years ago.
Now, I think that's a great way to move on to the next bit, which is to think about some items in your collection. Let's start with... you tell us what you want to start with.
How about a picture of the Queen?
Yeah. Oh, well, which Queen?
Oh, I can see which Queen it is. She
looks
more than
younger
one.
And more beautiful than I remember. No, sorry, this is Victoria, isn't it?
So we're definitely talking to Queen Victoria, and we all have this image of Queen Victoria. Old lady, rather portly, bit sort of Gary-shaped, wearing black. And that's our view of Queen Victoria. But this is a lithograph print of Queen Victoria, aged probably only about 19 or 20. Don't know what you think on that. But she's certainly young. And the print is signed. And
signed by?
By the Queen.
Now that in itself is amazingly rare, surely.
Yeah, which implies that there must be something more than it's just a print of the Queen. And the more astute amongst the two of you might notice that it's glazed on both sides because there's a lot of writing on the back. And for many years, there was a little sort of, it was actually a gun shop in Southsea. And the guy said to me, I've got this here print. It's to do with the Queen and a particular regiment, which I'll come to in a moment. And I went in there one day and said, I've decided to sell it. It's up on the wall. Oh, okay, better buy it then. And there's two things about the back of this. You can see where the very old frame has been, and then there's a lot of very faint, faded writing, mostly in the same hand, but the last three names are signatures. And it starts by saying, Officers, HM 32nd Regiment, Lucknow, Oud Province, 1st of July, 1857. So we all know about what happens on the 1st of July.
Battle of the Somme Day.
First Not in 1857.
Oh, no, yeah.
First day at Gettysburg. Not in 1857.
It's a lucky day, really, isn't it?
It's a strange day to have start a battle.
What do you reckon it is then?
Right. So these names are the officers of the 32nd Regiment of Foot.
Fine body of men, Gary.
I knew you were going to say that, Peter. Who were the core of the defence of the residency at Lucknow during the Indian Mutiny.
That ran from, I think, May 1857 through to November 1857?
Yeah, effectively. Now, they got involved in it when their regimental depot came under attack from the mutineers at a place called Cawnpore. And quite a few of the men and the families were killed in a short siege, and then they were given notionally safe passage down the river on boats, and the mutineers chased after them, and they were basically killed and thrown down the well.
Oh, it's the it's what was then popularly known as the Cawnpore Massacre.
Exactly. So part of the regiment went in that, but the rest of the regiment were at Lucknow, and they holed up into the residency. They didn't have enough manpower to secure the fort and the residency, so the residency was chosen. They defended that against a tremendous onslaught from the mutineers over many weeks, with increasing casualties. The man in charge of the defence, Sir Henry Lawrence, was killed on the fourth day of the siege. There was mine warfare from the mutineers, who kept trying to undermine the defences, and they were initially relieved by Sir Henry Havelock on the 25th of September with a small relief force who promptly got bottled in as well. So these guys then, they continue defending the residency until it was about the 22nd of November when they were finally relieved. So what's the picture? Well, it's got all of the names of the officers present during the siege that are in the contemporary list, plus one. And this is, the extra name is the adjutant, who was definitely there. So that gives very strong evidence that it's a contemporary piece. And it's almost certainly either the officer's mess picture of the Queen from the 32nd or the residency picture of the Queen. Now, there's extra provenance. There's a piece of parchment in the back, saying he was found in Truro Market in 1896 by a gentleman called Corporal F.J. Clemo, 2nd DCLI. Fred Clemo is an interesting character in his own right. He won the Distinguished Conduct Medal in the Boer War, Battle of Paardeberg, which was 2nd DCLI's major action. He was a colour sergeant by then. By 1913, he was RSM, 2nd Battalion, out in Hong Kong with the battalion, who incidentally became Marines on HMS Triumph when that ship was reactivated on the outbreak of war. And then they came back, and 2nd DCLI formed a part of one of the truly forgotten divisions that no one knows about, 27th Division, which was Regulars. And he fought with them through battles at St. Eloy, south of Ypres, 2nd Ypres, right the way through to November 1915, when he was effectively discharged to commission. He was an old soldier by this time. And he became lieutenant and quartermaster with the 1st, 7th Worcestershires. But then things go very murky, because his medal index card says that he was discharged by general court-martial in mid-1918. It was about August 1918. And he can't find either his papers or anything relating to the court-martial. Now, he got his, so he lost his medals, but he got his medals back in 1928, and he went on into the and survived until after the Second World War.
That's as interesting as the, yeah, the original
so,
picture.
So there's that second backstory with one item, and it's an ongoing mystery because he can't find his papers. There's wow. nothing in the war diaries for the Worcesters, but this guy, an old soldier, DCM, been an RSM, was he a dodgy quartermaster? Did he get drunk?
Is there any other type?
Do we ever know any problems with quartermasters? Is there anyone out there?
That's a great story, and there's lots of resonances now because I presume when Lucknow was relieved that the relieving forces treated the remaining mutineers with respect and
absolutely as one does.
They massacred them.
Basically.
Yeah, which is you know, it's an interesting topic, and the whole of the Indian Mutiny, I think we will return to in one of the podcasts. But we'd better move on. Right, well, that's a great start, Andy. But so what have you got second for us? I can see you clutching something to your bosom,
and it's not a shiny badge.
It's not a shiny badge. In fact, it looks like a grotty book.
Yeah, it's SS-615.
SS.
Oh. That sounds like a cookbook.
No, it doesn't. I'd have thought it sounded like a tactical how-to-employ-a-machine-gun.
No, it sounds like what you call a
well,
cookbook.
The SS series of books, booklets, covered a huge range of things.
Yeah, I seem to remember that one, though, because that was my favourite when I was in
stationary service, Andy?
Something like that, yeah.
I think it's stationary service.
But it's a document issued by the Quartermaster General's branch, which should imply something that, yes, of course it's a cookbook. Because this is a man
it.
Who knows his food.
Yeah, I've ate my way through that. The fish okay. cakes are particularly lovely.
And it's a lovely little book, which in essence is a recipe book. Because when you actually delve into how you fight a battle, one of the most important things you do is you feed the guys first. And you keep them fed. And we've got to remember that at the time of the Great War, there wasn't an armoury catering corps. All of the catering was done at battalion level. So there had to be guidance that came down from above and those that were knowledgeable.
How many people would that be for, Andy? How many people could you feed based on those recipes?
There's two groups of recipes here, 50 men or 100 men. So it's not insignificant quantities.
So like 25 or 50 Garys?
Something like that, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But what you've got to remember here...
Are you saying I'm twice the man I used to be?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Moving on. Sorry.
What you've got to remember here is that this was taken very seriously. If you look at a lot of the war diaries at divisional level, the boring adjutant quartermaster branch war diaries... Some of those diaries have got so much information in there because they publish all of the weekly orders. And one thing they were really hot on was the hygiene in the kitchens. There wasn't any of this here, you're allowed to smoke or anything like that when you're cooking the food. They were really hot on it. And most people don't get that. You see a lot of parodies where the fag ash is falling into the soup. No, that wasn't allowed. So this book, it's got recipes for soups, and it's got things like cooking chestnuts. There's a range of puddings. Now, maybe we shouldn't talk about puddings until we talked about mains. There's a nice recipe there for fish cakes.
Yeah, let's hear this recipe.
So you're a clever fellow. Let's see if we can find it again. It's...
Is this for in the field, Andy, or is this for
Yeah, it's
barracks?
Cooking in the field. And there's diagrams of how you build the ovens and stuff like that. So, fish cakes for 100 men. Have a guess at what the main ingredient is, please.
Fish!
Potato.
Okay. So, yes, in part of it is 10 tins of herrings. There's also 4 pounds of potatoes.
Ooh, I like potatoes.
And there's some pepper. And there's some breadcrumbs. Give it a bit of bulk. You would know all about that, Gary. And a little stock. But what's the main ingredient? It's none of those. First one on the list is 10 tins of bully beef.
I love the army.
Okay. So the main ingredient in your fish cake is bully beef.
Excellent. Gives you that meaty flavour.
I suppose it's not plum jam.
So it's a good job you weren't a vegetarian in 1917. Now, you've got to have your three-course meal, so there's recipes for soup. But there's also things here. It's called biscuit for 100 men. And this is a series of recipes. Dumplings. Biscuit pastry. Scones.
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 Oh, no, you're not going to have that argument. Which side of the fence do which you swing?
Scone.
Okay.
I can't believe it. We've never agreed on a pronunciation.
Okay. Rock cakes.
Rock.
Rock.
And cake. Dundee pudding. So the catering was actually taken very seriously. It wasn't just the monotonous diet. And there's actually in here one page, which is a sample menu for a whole week as to what they get for all of their meals. And it's quite a balanced diet because... In a perfect world. But in reality, things weren't too bad. There's a very nice story. It was written by a guy called... Ben Keeling. Keeling is an interesting character in his own right. He was a mate of Keir Hardy, Labour Party fame.
I remember him.
Okay, yeah, you probably do, Pete.
I am old.
You are old. H.G. Wells, Winston Churchill, and he actually joined up with Rupert Brooke. But that's a different story. But this guy, Keeling, he wrote for the New Statesman. And he wrote a story which was published, I think, in early 1916 called The Bully Beef Mine. And it was a bit of a parody about quartermasters again and how the army dealt with surplus. Because the principle was that if you had 800 men on ration strength, you got 800 rations. If you got 1,000 men, you got 1,000 rations. But there was no concept with the quartermaster that if there was surplus of something, there was no way of not taking that. So they ended up with surpluses of things like biscuits, which they came up with all sorts of ideas for in this parody, like dainty meals for mules. And they found they would burn nicely, so biscuit fires had a particular bluish tinge. But the bully beef, they had ideas where these were turned into rissoles. And then there was so much bully beef that they ended up burying it. And the parody comes in at the end that in times of shortage, you would see men hunting the sites of former camps with pick and shovel, looking for deposits of bully beef left behind. It's written up in the New Statesman.
In the New Statesman as a left-wing magazine is, of course, true.
Absolutely. You also had to contend with those special mice. Was it Hanoverian mice that could eat through the rations?
That's right. I remember that. Right, let's get down. The next thing is something that's really conventional in the sense of a collector, and that's material related to Lieutenant Rupert Moon. He's a VC, a Victoria Cross. Now, you haven't got the VC because you're not a millionaire and your collection is interesting rather than super valuable. Tell us a bit about it, because there's a photograph there. I can see it.
It's
handsome young lad.
It's an interesting photograph.
There's a sort of ribbony thing underneath it.
Yeah, you leave that for the minute. We'll come back to that bit. This photograph, you mentioned the Belgian connection just now. Got a lot of friends in Belgium. And one of my Belgian friends, he said, Frankie, he's got this photograph. I told him he ought to sell it to you. He found it in a flea market in Brussels. Lo and behold, it's a picture of an Australian officer with his signature on it. And the signature is Rupert Moon.
It's very legible.
It's very legible. And
1917.
And in the photo, he's wearing the ribbon of the VC and the ribbon of the 15 star. And, of course, the prize is that in the frame with it are the two original ribbons with a little bronze VC emblem on the VC ribbon. And it is clearly what he actually wore on his uniform. Now, it's the closest I'm going to come to owning a VC. The original is in public hands. It's in the Australian War Memorial at Canberra. So the Aussies have got the originals.
And that's probably where it should be.
And it's where it should be.
I have a personal opinion, which Gary would probably disagree with, that everybody who owns a VC is a complete wanker. That's not a public institution, but unless it's a member of the family. It's harsh words, but
fair.
It'd be nice Ascot, to see families still own some of the VCs.
I would prefer that. But they're worth so much money. People like Ashcroft will pay tens, twenties, hundreds of thousands of pounds for them. Yeah, and if you're a normal family...
You're probably talking $250,000 on a Great Boar VC, easy. Yeah.
You can't turn aside $250,000 if you're living in a back street house in Salford.
Exactly.
His VC was awarded for an action on the 12th of May... 1917, wasn't it, near Bullecourt?
It was Bullecourt. It was 58th Battalion, Australian Imperial Force. He was involved in the fighting between OG1 and OG2, the old German Line 1 and old German Line 2. And he,
no imagination there, Jones.
And he ended up leading a small patrol trying to capture a blockhouse. He got wounded four times, including in the face. Apparently he was wounded in the jaw, and He clearly recovered quickly, although the write-ups of the VC talk about him being severely wounded. Rupert Boone, he was allegedly severely wounded, but he was back with his battalion from hospital within about 3 to 4 weeks.
Now, I said to Pete on the way here, you know, lots of people get wounded in action. You know, what's he done to win a VC? And he pointed out to me that it was not just wounded once, it was four times.
It was four times.
And he continued to lead his men.
Was that what it was for then? Basically leadership in extremis, that sort of thing?
I believe so. I've not seen anything that suggests otherwise.
I couldn't find anything else about it, really.
I've not seen anything that suggests it was a politically motivated to beef up the numbers of VCs to Empire troops or anything like that. There's no evidence at all.
And he survived the war.
He survived the war. He was back in Brussels by 1919. He went home to Australia after being wounded. He came back to the Western Front, and apparently he was in Brussels in 1919. And one assumes that the photograph was given to a lady friend or whatever.
Or whatever.
No, whatever. He did, in fact, enjoy a long life, didn't he? He worked in banking after the war.
I think he was a banker.
Yeah,
and that's a banker, Peter.
Yeah, he was a banker, Peter.
All right, a banker.
A what?
Merchant banker.
Yeah, he was a merchant banker.
I was stunned to see when he died, just how late it was. He was the last surviving one, I think, from the group. But he died in 1986, didn't he? Which is quite recently to me.
Yeah, that is quite recent.
You know, it's...
But he's a young fellow, though, in 1917.
Yeah, 28th of February 1986, last but one surviving. And the other one died about 6 weeks later, William Joynt. Yeah. Now, what's next then?
I think we're going to move on to the Webbing Haversack.
Yeah, so.
Which I've got here.
So yeah, in 19.
Pretty ordinary looking thing.
It's a very ordinary looking thing. In 1908, as a result of lessons learned in the South African War. A webbing set of equipment was introduced, which became the standard and was pretty good because he could be put on like
Gillingham
a jacket.
Taft speaks brilliantly about how practical it was.
Yeah, and it even goes round him.
Not now.
Okay. And
do you think it would go around Gary?
Have you decided to leave me alone then?
Oh, I've just come back to you.
it is quite ordinary, but why would that catch the eye of a collector, Andy?
Well, it probably wouldn't because someone's messed around with it and the back of it's painted pink.
Right. Did you do that?
Well, I know why it's painted pink.
Did Carol do it?
No.
Have I coloured it in absentmindedly?
No, just south of the River Thames is this lovely little museum-y type thing. Okay, and they've got some really good archives. And one thing as a collector you've got to do is target the archives to gain the knowledge that informs what you should buy and when.
That's the War Museum.
That's the War Museum,
a wonderful
Pete.
Institution.
Allegedly, you had been seen there on occasion.
Well, I was the interviewer. It was my job to be elsewhere.
Right. Never mind. Anyway, in the War Museum, there's a set of archives, which, with great foresight, a series of questionnaires were sent out to the units in 1917, saying, what insignia did you wear? And most of the units responded, certainly most of the infantry battalions. And what it shows is there was some very good tactical thinking and lots of good planning, despite this here great mythology of lions led by donkeys and all that bollocks. So part of this here planning was you need to know how to recognise your troops. And let's bust a myth straight away. All the soldiers were told to advance carrying their packs. Rubbish. They tended to carry on their back their haversack, because that carried things like the unconsumed portion of the day's ration and stuff like that. So they wore these small packs or haversacks on their back. And the ideal place to put some sort of recognition mark, if you're trying to see how far your troops have gone, is right in the middle of their back. So the 7th Division, who were in the sector south of Mametz, their scheme was the two assaulting brigades. One had yellow cloth or yellow paint on the back of the haversack. And the 20th Brigade, their battalions, their haversacks were painted pink, or they had a big rectangular pink cloth tacked onto them. So this here is actually a relic of the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And it's something that most people would ignore simply because, oh, somebody's been at it with the paint.
Well, that's what we I thought it was Gary.
Well, no, I mean, you hear of the metallic triangle, don't you? 29th
The Twinklers.
29th Division, yeah.
Exactly the same.
But you wouldn't think something as simple as just painting the haversack pink
would be
thought of.
It's a big swatch of colour right in the middle of the back of the guy, and you get a reasonable idea of how far they've got. And of course, now these guys, the 20th Brigade, included the 8th and 9th Devons.
Oh, we've been to their graveyard.
Okay, some Mansell Copse. They attacked out of Mansell Copse, down, of course, to where the machine gun was on the corner of the cemetery opposite.
They were ambushed, weren't they?
Captain Martin, who had made the prediction with his plasticine models of what was actually going to happen. So that piece of kit.
And the Reverend Cross buried them.
Yeah, he was cross, wasn't
it? He was cross after he'd done that.
Yeah. So you can actually tie this artefact to a particular day in history.
That's wonderful. That really is wonderful. That's fascinating. We'll put pictures of these things up so people can share our amusement in it all. Now, let's see what's... Oh, the next one. Gary's put it on his head. Well, Gary, you look... It may be a bit too small for you.
It was very small, actually. And this is a German pickle howl.
It is.
Now, who did that belong to, and how have you got it in your possession?
Anyway? Now, this is one that turned up at one of the military affairs, I don't know, 20 years ago. When you look at the pictures, you'll see it's actually, looks if it's been there. It's because it has. It's got its original cover with the green numerals on the front. Reserve Regiment 242. And inside it's named to a Soldat Weiger. Okay, that's important. Because Weiger, as far as I can determine, is in the mass grave at Langemark. And his date of death is the 21st of October 1914. And his regiment, Reserve Regiment 242, was part of the first wave of German reserve formations that were put together at the very beginning of the war, including the young university volunteers.
Oh, the myth of
the Kinderborgen.
Well, the myth's later, isn't it? Myth's November. So this is part... This was a two-day battle, I think, wasn't it?
This battle was a little bit longer. These guys... First Ypres, the 242 was the first German regiment to come in contact with the British at a place called Kreisacker Crossroads. It's out to the east of Gellivelt. That regiment took, I think it was 6 days, to do the half a mile up to Gellivelt. And they took about 60% casualties, including him.
So this could have been a souvenir. What's your problem?
Almost certainly souvenired. Brought back by someone in, it would have been 7th Division, who were on point at that area.
It was 7th, yeah.
Yeah. And
of course you know, sorry.
Yeah. And it's an example of something from literally the first day of the first Battle of Ypres. So that one has actually spent quite a bit of time on display in the Ariane as part of that display you mentioned, Gary. It also spent a little bit of time, I had it on loan for a while in Flanders Fields Museum in Ypres when they were running an exhibition with stuff from collectors. So it's definitely half and half. The Germans were still learning their tactics at the time. These were reservists that had done some of the basic training. So the German regular regiments went out the front door of the depots, and the reservists came in the back door, kitted out, and they were sent off to war as well. Because we're only talking here of October, so we're not very far in. So the ability to learn has been absolutely minimal.
I think one thing that I would advise, if people want to know more about the German army at First Ypres, is to read Jack Sheldon's book, which has lots of great quotes in, although not obviously one from Soldat Ryger. But we've recommended Jack's work before. It's difficult for the English to read because it's different names, different units, different everything. And that makes it seem a difficult read. But it is absolutely fascinating stuff. And the quotes are brilliant. And Jack's work is fantastic.
And the Germans had a slightly different organisation. A German regiment was like a British brigade.
Yes.
Whereas a British regiment is very much a family of battalions that could be anywhere.
Well, people say that, you know, because it doesn't read as fluently because it's all new to us. That's why.
Exactly.
The stuff, the work is brilliant.
As a collector or a historian, sometimes you've got to look at both sides of the picture if you're going to try to understand anything.
And I would say if people visit the Ypres area, there's a number of German cemeteries, obviously. You've got Vladslow not far, but Langemark is certainly something you should visit. It's got a very different atmosphere to it to some of the British and Commonwealth ones.
It is. It's more gloomy. That may be the trees.
It is trees.
Yeah, you could be right. I turned up there once on Armistice Day on my own, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the ground was still covered with sort of freezing mist, and you looked in through the portal, and those figures were still at the on the back wall before they'd been moved. And I thought, nope, not going in there today.
Now, so the next thing, very briefly, this is quite a dramatic thing. It's a Lancy thing.
It's a Lancy thing, yeah.
But it's to the 3rd Hussars. That piqued my interest.
Yeah, so tell me what the problem is with the Lance to the 3rd Hussars.
Swordy things, rifle-y things.
Hussars in the British...
They don't have lances.
Hussars didn't carry lances.
It's hot. They don't carry lances.
And instead of the little red and white pennon on there, which you normally see on lances, this thing has got a faded blue flag on it with a white horse and the words 3rd King's Hussars. And you think, okay, it's got to be a story here. And the story is actually quite simple. It's the colonel's flag. Okay? And you can put the flag on something. You can put it on a lance because those things are available. And how do we know it's the colonel's flag? There's a little bone tag with it, grave tag. And it came from a country house down in Kent. Unfortunately, time had taken its toll on it, so it's not perfect condition. But the bone tag says, the colonel's flag, carried in the advance to victory in 1918. So again, it's an object that's a one-off that you can actually tie back to a period in time, and you can set up that vision in your mind of this column of cavalry in late summer of 1918 moving forward, colonel at the front, his orderly behind him with the flag.
Fantastic. And if you want to read more about it, I notice you have a copy of the... Well, you can't read Andy's, but there's the history of the 3rd Hussars.
Third King's own
Fine
Hussars.
Body of men.
And these were a bunch of guys that had been on the Western Front from the early days of the war in 1914. They were involved in the Ypres sector around Fletcher, around the Casale area. So, yeah, these guys have had a long history on the Western Front, most of it albeit as mounted infantry and reserves ready to move forward as infantry with mobility.
The only fast-moving force at Haig's disposal, because tanks aren't fast-moving, are they?
So if you read the accounts of the 8th of August 1918, 1 hour after the infantry started, three cavalry divisions started moving forward and passed through the infantry, passed the tanks and went on the rampage behind German lines.
I always like that whenever the Australians are saying they've got that big railway gun thing outside the Canberra Museum, that was captured by British cavalry, and then the Australians came and stole it. That, which is so much British negligence.
Yeah, there's a nice little side story there. I think it was one of the cavalry units. I think it might have been Inniskillen Dragoons. Came into a German railway marshalling yard at pretty much a full gallop, just as the German troop train was trying to unload, and the results were not good for the Germans.
Well, they are a part of the paint set that you paint the picture of war with.
People forget
in their place.
People forget that on those particular occasions, they were invaluable because they had mobility. And they had greater mobility than other arms.
And they were trained to do everything that a soldier could do. And then they could use the arme blanche as well, the sword, if necessary, but very rarely. Think of them as not... I mean, Haig would never allow you to call them mounted infantry, but because he hated mounted infantry. But in effect, that's what they are.
Well, he described them as all-round soldiers.
All-round.
Mounted infantry, thought were fairly limited.
Well, it's because they couldn't ride and they couldn't shoot.
And they didn't look after the horses.
So that is a really interesting... Now, the last thing we're going to talk to you about is three separate things. And we've got a photograph of them as well, which we'll have put photographs of all these things up. And that's three rifles. Now, let's go to from left to right in the picture. So what's on the left?
So on the left...
It's longer than the other ones.
Because it's known as a Long Lee. It's a Long Lee Enfield. It dates from about 1900. And effectively, it's the action of Mr. Enfield, sorry, it's the action of Mr. Lee with the rifling of Mr. Enfield. The predecessor had been the Lee Metfield. So this was the new weapon that was coming in towards the end of the Boer War. So by 1907, new weapons were coming in. So this became partially obsolete. It was converted for loading with charger clips in about 1910. All stamped up on it.
That's the five-round clips.
Five-round clips that everyone would recognise.
Two in.
Yeah.
Two clips in.
Two clips worth,
yeah. Two in?
It's 10-round magazine. So it's a long magazine, the Enfield. So, okay. And the interesting thing about this one is on the outbreak of war, this semi-obsolescent rifle was issued to a lot of units. The Royal Naval Division carried them. Lots of battalions in training in the UK had these things. But this one's a little bit different because on the butt plate, the unit markings are stamped. And they're stamped 9 ES, 9th East Surreys. So firstly, what do we know about the 9th East Surreys? Journey's End. It's the Journey's End Battalion.
No. Is it the one, what's his name, the football one was in as well? Or was that the 8th?
No, that's the 8th. You're thinking of Billy Neville.
Yeah. So there was a book written about the 9th, the Journey's End Battalion, because I've got it. I haven't read it.
But the other thing to note is the 9th East Surreys were part of the 24th Division, who were rushed over to the Western Front relatively prematurely in early September 1915. And they went in on the second day at the Battle of Loos. And at that time, they were still equipped with the Long Lee rifle rather than the SMLE. So this rifle was almost certainly used in action on the Battle of Loos.
That's quite something. Gary, what do you want to ask about the second one?
Well, the second one is the short magazine, the Enfield, and it's the one in the middle on the picture. Now, this is a Mark I, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's the early version from about 1907. Very quickly bypassed in the evolution of the SMLE, because the main one that everyone went to war with in 1914 was the number one Mark III, which had its magazine cut off and volley sights and all of that stuff. But this intermediate one, a few territorial units had purchased these, including the London Scottish, the London Jocks. And the London Scottish carried number one Mark I's into action in their first action, which was the 31st of October 1914, on the Messines Ridge.
That's quite an important action.
It's a very important action, both for the London Scottish and, I suppose, the territorial force in general. And generally, the problem with the number one Mark I was it was designed to chamber a style of 303 ammunition that had a round-nosed bullet. The normal SMLE fired a pointy bullet. So that what happened was that these rifles, when they tried to use the modern ammunition in these older rifles, they wouldn't feed properly and they became single loaders rather than magazine loaders. So the firepower was greatly diminished, and most of these rifles were thrown away as quickly as they decently could. And most of the lads from the London Scottish picked up rifles from the cavalry who were fighting alongside them, casualties in the cavalry, and they fought with normal SMLEs. Now, this particular rifle, I believe we can trace this one back a little bit. Came to me a few years ago. It had previously been in Oxfordshire, and it had previously been in Ypres. And it had been in the collection of a good friend in Ypres, who died about 12, 13 years ago. Great gun collector. And this weapon had been picked up by his father on the Messines Ridge in 1919. And if you look closely at the rifle, it's pitted and a little bit rusted, as if it had been out on the fields for 4 years, 5 years. And this is almost certainly a rifle from that day, 31st of October, 14, and it spent World War II hidden behind a furnace in the family home, even though there were Germans billeted in the house. Because this guy, his name was Tony de Bruyn, he was well known in Ypres. It only came out really after he died that most people knew he'd been sort of involved as a teenager, as a runner for the resistance. He'd actually been quite intimately involved in the Belgian resistance network. So there's another little interesting sideline.
Wow, that is good detective work as well.
Yeah.
Now, the third and the last thing for today, that looks more, that even I think that looks more normal. It's the one on the right. Tell me about that.
It's an absolutely standard SMLE number one Mark III star. It's the mid-war. They've simplified it as much as they can to improve production. And this one was found with its matching bayonet in an attic in Harwich. Now, I've got it because it's marked to the 3rd Battalion DCLI. Happened to be the Special Reserve Battalion. The bayonet's also marked the same battalion. That's very unusual. So what was this rifle doing with its bayonet in an attic in Harwich? Almost certainly a deserter's weapon, where somebody got fed up with the war. I'm going to put my civvies on, stick this here damn rifle out of the way. So that's really all we can say about that. Deserter's weapon.
Wow. So that's it for it's a wonderful collection. It's great. One thing I tend to ask about questions, have you ever thought of wearing any of this kit, of perhaps wandering around pretending to be a soldier or a reenactor or something?
Or a Japanese admiral.
Or a Japanese admiral, as I myself am the Japanese
admiral.
Yes,
there is most certainly a community that get great pleasure in living history and recreating the times correctly, and there's some good friends who have done that in the past.
And we've learned some practical things from them.
That's right, and they are the people that do it properly. And then there are another community that perhaps like taking things out of the dressing up box.
I don't think you need to say any more. So not for you, that.
So no, I've never worn any of the stuff.
I used to work at the War Museum. What about when you fall off your perch? What do you want to happen to your? Hopefully not for 2 or 3 years yet. What do you? You've only got 6 months, Gary. What do you want to happen to your collection? Do you want to keep it together, or do you want some lucky person to sell it, or do you want to or give it to a museum? What do you want to happen to it?
That's a difficult question, Pete, because some of the things there clearly ought to go into museum collections. Probably not the War Museum, because the First World War stuff I've got is...
They'd sell it.
They've got lots of it. But there are one or two items from the early Victorian period that probably ought to end up in the reserve collection of NAM, because they are absolute one-offs. There's no surviving examples other than the examples upstairs that really should end up there. The other thing, of course, is to try to document stuff. And one of the things that I have been doing over the last few years is photographing not only the stuff that I've got, but some of the stuff in the IWM, where people have really helped me out with
access. They are wonderful.
And putting that together into a coherent picture that tells much more of a story than is currently available in the reference works. So, yeah, I've got various projects ongoing in the background, writing stuff up, documenting.
Are we going to see a book?
Yeah, quite possibly. There's one that's at least 95% complete.
What would it be about?
I did think of doing another cookbook, but I don't think I've got quite the charisma of Nigella to be able to take it to TV.
I don't know. Well, we've heard all about your curry. I think don't write it off.
Well, there is a recipe for curry in here, and I would have quite happily made you a curry to that recipe, but I couldn't get the bully beef.
No, I'm waiting for the fish cakes.
On that note, thank you very much. We've enjoyed a chatter, haven't we?
It's been a pleasure, Pete and Gary.
Cheers, Andy.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?